And I'd just like to hand you over to the fabulous Noel Thompson from BBC TV. Big round of applause for Noel, please, who'll introduce our speakers.
Who's missing?
Michael Copeland.
He said it'd be late, so...
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, absolute delight to be here, and what a show we've had so far. Nelson Mandela. I actually missed the punchline of Nelson Mandela because everyone was laughing so much, but I caught up with it. I used to work, Mervyn was talking about the yard being outside. I used to work in Carpex at the Ropeworks. Don't know if you remember Carpex. I was there for many years, a carpet shop. And one afternoon, a wee woman came in and she came over to me and said, "Right, son." I said, "Hello, what can I do for you?" She said, "I want a wee bit of carpet for the yard." And I said, "Are you sure?" She said, "I want a bit of carpet for the yard." I said, "But will it not get a bit wet?" She said, "You don't understand, son. It's one of them new houses. The yard's up the stairs." So anyway, great fun. The play and the readings have all been most interesting, most illuminating. But now we're going to kind of change the direction a little bit. Here's Michael now. That's great. Perfect timing, Michael. Good man. And we're going to talk a little bit about where the unionist stroke, loyalist stroke, Protestant community has come from, is, and is going to. Hello, Michael. Come and join us, please. Well, you could have been further, but it's great. So you're just absolutely perfect timing. So my panel to my left is Sammy Douglas. As you will all know, has been a community activist in this part of the world for many decades, and then he sold out his principles and became a politician. But we'll forgive him. Jackie McDonald is down here as with the Ulster Political Research Group, a group that we in the media came to know as, or came to call, a group close to the thinking of the paramilitaries. Very close, I think. Also better known perhaps now, Jackie, as a presidential golfing partner. John Kyle very bravely took up the cudgels and led the PUP, and, well, not sure where he took it, but it's still there, and it just had its party meeting at the weekend. And Michael Copeland has been in and out of Stormont doing the hokey cokey for the Ulster Unionists, and he's there now, and very pleased to see you with us, Mike. You missed a great show. I knew you probably had constituency duties to do, but anyway. But yeah, it was absolutely terrific. Anyway, so here we are. Maybe we just start just to reflect the theme of the evening so far, and ask each of you gentlemen, just for the sake of this process, your own memories of Ian Paisley, or thoughts about Ian Paisley. Sammy first.
Thanks, Noel. I first met Ian Paisley. I originally grew up in Sandrews, as most people know, but I've lived in East Belfast for about 20 years. And I remember meeting him as a 9-year-old boy in Sandro at a mission hall, and he was just coming into the hall, and the thing that struck me was just the size of him and this woman, Edie Sherlock, or Edie Padlock as we used to call her, Big Edie. And Edie said, "This is Sammy Douglas, he helps us in this hall." And he said to me, "You know something, you're doing this for the Lord, always remember that." And that was my first memories of him. I think the other thing that some of the stuff was good tonight, but I think I'm only in the DUP about 18 months, so Paisley predated me. But one of the things that didn't come out tonight was that he got the biggest vote ever in Europe for many years. He definitely had the support out there. Support in this area here in many ways. A lot of people opposed him as well, including the Loyalist Paramilitaries, remember, you know, over the years. So, and finally, I'd say as well, he suffered at the end. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Lost huge support within the church, huge support within the DUP when he eventually did the deal. As somebody said to me, well, if he had prepared us for that the DUP would go into the government with Sinn Féin, it may have been easier, but it was literally overnight. I think I was, looking back, that was a major mistake. But I think he suffered from that, and he came good in the end, and I think Northern Ireland's in a far better place than it was in those early days.
Okay. Jackie?
Thanks, Sam. Thanks, Noel.
Well, just on what Sammy said, I disagreed with Paisley for since I became a member of the paramilitary organisation. I had a different view of Ian Paisley than I had before I joined it. I just thought, like everybody else, he was the greatest and believed everybody said and met different places with him. But as time moved on and when Paisley had sort of control of the paramilitaries, going back to the early 70s, everybody just went along with him. But as we got more experienced in what we were doing, and I'm talking about people, the more senior positions myself, going back to the likes of 74. But during the strike in 74, if you remember, Paisley wasn't here. He was in Canada, I think, when it all kicked off. And I remember the boys telling me a story when the LAW was in having one of their meetings. There's UDA, UVF, all the people you would know about were in the room. Glennie Barr, Andy Terry, people like that were all in the room. And they were told, the security was told not to let anybody else in. And Paisley arrived late, but they let him in anyway. And he sat, I think the boys were having a sort of a recess, but Paisley sat in Glennie Barr's chair. And when Glennie came back into the room, he says, "That's my chair." And Paisley says, "Well, I'm comfortable here. This is the most comfortable chair for me." And the boy says, "Well, you have to move." And he says, "No, I'm all right where I am." So they lifted him, chair and all, and sat him outside. You know, and I think that's when the paramilitaries were making a statement. They had been used, you know, and I'm not saying this in a derogatory way because we're all new to the game then, but we're being used. And it was around about that time that loyalism of the paramilitaries themselves began to have, they realised the power they had. They were getting more and more experienced at what they were doing. And they made up their own mind what they were going to do. People can say one thing or the other, whether they did the right thing or did the wrong thing. But I don't think Paisley ever spoke to us again after that. And as years went past, and when it was the Ulster Democratic Party and in the UPRG and different things, we made many overtures to the DUP and Ian Paisley to talk to him to see if we could help move things on. And we never got so much as a reply. I understood where he was coming from. He couldn't talk to people like myself, maybe, without having to talk to Republicans. When he was saying things like, "Lock him up and throw away the key," many loyalists were saying, "Big Ian, he's right." When I was saying, "Hold on, there's loyalist prisoners in there too, they're going to throw away the key and everybody." And when he was saying, "Shoot to kill, kill the travelling gunman," you know, again, many loyalists think, "This is great." But there was travelling loyalist gunmen at the time too. But when it came to all that, and when it came to a bit a few years ago when Paisley had to say yes, he couldn't say maybe, because I believe if he had to try to say maybe or he had to try to explain what he was going to do, there would have been such an outcry that he couldn't have done it. So he had to go to the bed one night saying no and wake up the next morning saying yes. And I think it was one of the bravest things he ever did. And like somebody says, we wouldn't be here, we wouldn't be where we are today if it wasn't for him. And he has suffered greatly for
except
it.
Except if he'd done it in 1974. John.
Thanks, Noel. The first time I ever saw Ian Paisley was at the Gates of Stormont. I was passing and there was an accident. A little girl was knocked down. And Ian Paisley happened to be there. And his leadership gifts came to the fore. He immediately took control of the situation. I suppose you could say whether he knew what he was doing or not is another question. But he took control and got things organised in a very effective way. Subsequently, as some of you know, I work in Hollywood Arches Health Centre and I've seen Ian Paisley a number of times in there as he comes to visit his GP. He's nearly always accompanied by another gentleman who sits with him, keeping an eye on things. But I have to say, I disagree with Ian Paisley's politics and have done all my life. But as an individual, he is an extremely personable, affable, gracious man. And on a personal level, that's my experience. So I have to say that about him. He, and again, to, I suppose, agree with what Jackie has said. Ian Paisley said no for 30 or 40 years. I'm just glad that at the end he said yes. I think yes is a much better word than no. I think it's a much more constructive, positive, hopeful word. And I'm glad that at the end of the day, he said yes.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you. It may surprise you, but my earliest memory of Ian Paisley is over 50 years ago when he arrived in my grandmother's fish and chip shop on the Bearsbridge Road wearing a Russian hat before Russian hats had become popular. And there was another reverend gentleman, if that's the right word, in the shop at the same time. I forget his name, but he's the pastor of Whitewell Metropolitan Tabernacle. And he lived in Spring Street, and he used to come up, and he still talks, apparently, about my grand's pasties and his sermons. And Dr. Paisley, being Dr. Paisley, walked in and walked to the head of the queue. And that had severely annoyed a wee woman from Douglas Street, who didn't obviously know who he was, and she told him in no uncertain terms to go to the back of the queue. And my grandmother, to be honest with you, said exactly the same thing. I never really knew him in terms of politics. He was there or thereabouts during the first time I was in the Assembly, which was the time before last. And in many ways, he's a contrast. Just to echo what Jackie had said, there's actually another story about how he got into the strike meeting that day, because I happened to know someone who was doing security at the door. Dr. Paisley had arrived back from Canada and arrived at strike headquarters and announced he was there to take over the meeting, and went to put his hand on the door. The security guard, having been briefed in accordance with what Jackie had said, said, "Take your hand to that door." To which Dr. Paisley replied, "Do you know who I am?" And the fellow opened the door and asked, I think it was Andy Terry or Glenn Barr was in the chair, "There's a big fellow out here who doesn't know who he is." which is being perhaps rather unkind. Look, the truth is, Dr. Paisley is like all human beings. He is a political persona and he is a personal persona. I only ever saw the politics of it, and the politics of it, in my view, over a very long period of time, did nothing to solve problems, and in many occasions made problems almost insoluble. I, like many others, fell under the spell. I was in Newton Ards with the Third Force after I left the army. I remember vividly falling into what I thought was a parade from the City Hall that went through the markets. And it must have been the day of the air show, because the thing was strafed. It was overflown by Buccaneer jets. And I have to say, the population of the markets didn't seem particularly pleased to see us, but there was no major trouble. During the time that I served in the Ulster Defence Regiment, there were things said about I wouldn't put a dog in that, and it'll never be anything. I don't know whether his contribution in the early days could be described as positive, but when he said yes, he brought a pen and put a full stop under 40 years of murder and mayhem that should never have happened, if the truth be told. I do, and again, not supporting Jackie particularly, but stating the obvious, I get people in our office in the Albert Bridge Road every week, and had it not been for the troubles, they would never have done life in prison. They would never carry the memories of what they themselves did, and a lot of them would put it down to a mixture of not much else to do, too much drink, and listening to fire and brimstone of a political nature. He'll have to make his answer to his maker in due time. As I say, they eventually did say yes. It was a pity it just took so long.
All right, Michael. A man who still inspires strong feelings, for better or for worse. Let's move it on a little bit. Sammy Douglas, why are unionist population, loyalist population, Protestant population whinging so much these days?
It depends what you mean by whinging.
Well, about being alienated and, you know, ignored, and, you know, what's got into them?
Well, I think it's got particularly bad this past year, and certainly over the summer. I think that if you look at the violence over the summer, and in terms of the parades, where on the 12th afternoon, I was watching the parade up on the Crumlin Road at Ardoyne with a heli telly. I could see it in the police station, and because I'm on the policing board, and I asked to go and see it. And it struck me, and a number of people have said this, that there were so many restrictions placed on the Orange Order, and then consequently within an hour or so you had a parade coming out of Ardoyne with hundreds of people. and with no restrictions. And the same thing happened in a number of other parades where there. This year in particular, I think the Parades Commission made major mistakes. And I think if you went through East Belfast, you talk to people who wouldn't necessarily be hardline loyalist. I think they would come up with that that reason behind it. So for me, there were many problems there during that time.
But have people not got many more things to worry about today? Well, we know they have got many more things to worry about today than the parades, important as they are. In the overall daily, yearly life of a people, they're a small beer. So why is the concentration on that and not on the huge economic and social problems that, that affect everybody?
Well, I suppose that for people who have grown up in a unionist, loyalist, Protestant background, culture is very much part of them. So if you take away their culture, take away the whole aspect of them wanting to the parade, you're taking away something of their identity.
But it's not taken away. There are thousands of parades every year. There are less than a dozen that are controversial. Mm-hmm. So the parading culture is not being taken away from the loyalist community.
Yeah.
Move it on. Jackie, where do you stand on that one? I mean, do you blame the Parades Commission for loyalist alienation, Protestant alienation?
Well, I think I'm beginning to believe, and I've been talking to many people about it, that I think they're making ridiculous decisions now to try to put the onus back on the Orange or on to whoever is going to have a parade. Should it be the Bands or the Orange or whoever? I think some of the decisions they made recently are totally outrageous. Mm. And the only possible outcome could have been trouble.
But the Orders have always hated the Parades Commission. That's nothing new.
Well, I can understand that. But the decisions they've been making over recent years, as if they're up in the ante. You know, and I've met the police on a few occasions leading up to the 12th to try to. I went to Musgrave Street to talk about the problems that we're going to have, the ridiculous decision about the band supposed to be in the lodge, supposed to be back at Ardwin at 4 o'clock, which was would have created a havoc if it had happened the way they had anticipated. At the same time, friends of mine in Lisburn were complaining about they weren't being allowed to walk back from Crumlin Village. And if there had been trouble in Crumlin Village, and the obvious trouble that was going to be at Ardoyne, all parts in between would have kicked off too. So, and who would have been responsible for that? It would have been some of the ridiculous decisions made by the Parades Commission. Mm. And when you say that there's only, Sinn Féin would probably tell you there's only half a dozen. Parades now is contentious. Mm. You're saying a dozen, well, but there's, how many don't happen at all now? How many have been rerouted? How many don't go where they used to be contentious? It's not just, there's 12 left and that's all to be sorted. There's been many sacrifices made by the Orange during that time. Mm. You know, and
okay, but I'm still slightly concerned, Michael Copeland, that we're defining it, or these two guys are defining the problems of the Protestant loyalist unionist community as being all about parading and marching when there's so many other things.
The only way I could reference that is by the traffic, if that's the right word, or the cases that come to me as an MLA in East Belfast. And I get an awful lot. Parading would not amount to 0.5%. It's the real stuff. It's children that have no anchor in life. It's people who have nothing that defines them. It's the notion. And forgive me for saying this, but an awful lot of people, because I'm ex-service myself, I would get an awful lot of my wife's an ex-police officer, I would get an awful lot of ex-police officers and ex-soldiers with benefit stuff. And talking to them, not as an MLA, but as a person-to-person, an ex-serviceman to an ex-serviceman, there's an awful underlying feeling that the bad guys won. There's an awful under feeling that the bad guys won. I sit every day in Stormont, that's just Sammy, well not every day, but more days than I'm happy with. And in that room are people who would previously have considered me, my wife, our family and people like us as suitable candidates for murder. And that,
it's more difficult for me. We are where we are now. That battle has been lost for better or for worse. It's how a community asserts itself and reasserts itself in the new environment?
I have absolutely no illusion about where we are, and where we are is a better place than where we might have been and where we had been. Please don't misunderstand me. But you ask the psyche that's behind it.
Mm.
Everything that defined East Belfast as a place, manufacturing industry, close-knit communities in the days before community was a word, because community is a word that I've only heard over the last maybe 10, 15 years. A real community doesn't need to be called a community, it's a neighbourhood. And the whole structure, the redevelopment, the Newton Ards Road used to be a thriving commercial road. Conswater came, Newton Ards Road dried up. The Craigie Road is the only, in my view, surviving ribbon development Victorian microeconomic structure on the county downside of the River Laggan. And the answer is to put in other Tesco's in the Castlereagh Road. And in my view, the Craigie Road will be a desert within 3 or 4 years. So the way in which we lived is different. I remember, as I said, I mentioned my grandmother's chip shop and my dad had a wee shop beside it. I remember a Saturday night on the Bearsbridge Road was like a Sunday afternoon in the Champs-Élysées. Mm. Now, you had people walking up and down, not doing anything, boys chasing girls, girls chasing boys.
I want to bring John in here, but I mean, that has got very little to do with the fact that the bad guys won.
The underlying psyche is people do think that the bad guys won.
Yeah. I suppose...